individually a great kind of telescopic and kaleidoscopic arrangement of ego states that we're able to hold and sense. We go run up and down these ego states, and depending upon what we're doing in life, and then there are ego states beyond those that we can't really hold. And when people dream, we talk about rapid eye movement dreaming. When people are dreaming, say the people at the Stanford Dream Research Place, and their eyes are moving very rapidly, and they can wake them up and they'll tell them what they're dreaming. But when they have no eye motion at all, they say they're not dreaming. There's no consciousness. They can't tell us what it really is. They just say there's no consciousness. Well, that's not true. It's just another kind of consciousness, but you can't remember what it is. When you wake up from a state like that, you don't know. It's not because you suddenly don't have consciousness. It's because whatever you're doing and wherever you are, however you're handling yourself at that time, is something that can't be brought back in terms that we, through our five-sense reality, could apprehend and hold and understand. But as people begin to develop higher and more expanded consciousness, they begin to bring back more of this and to understand more of this. Now, I'm not saying that really developed people remember all the dreams and undeveloped people don't remember the dreams. That is not the case. As a matter of fact, many very experienced teachers of spiritual things have said it's actually the other way around. People who go into what seems to be a dream of sleep are the ones who are probably the most active and actually working in the night, more than people who are actually experiencing vivid dreams. But there is a thing that we call lucid dreaming, and it's one of the things that we work with in this temple training after we do the purifications, and that it can be worked with, and it is in fact something one has to work with in order to achieve certain things. We mentioned the use of pomegranate juice and other things in the work with the Antahkarana, or with the continuity of consciousness between different levels of reality within ourselves. And when one starts to develop the ability to dream lucidly, which many of us have probably experienced in different kinds of ways, where that is the common experience is in your sleep, you wake up, but you're still asleep, and you know you're asleep. And then when you're asleep and you wake up and you know you're asleep, but you wake up in your sleep, in other words, you all of a sudden you bring your ego consciousness into your dream, and instead of the dream running you around, you start running the dream around. And then as you get more lucid, you find you can actually do things with it, and this allows you to actually do things in a conscious way that are purposeful at nighttime. And as one achieves more and more mastery, and a characteristic of some of the great masters is that they are working all the time. When they go to sleep, they're still working just as much as they are during the daytime, and they're doing it consciously. They know what they're doing, they know where they are, where they're going, and why. And the only purpose of sleep is to create a certain condition that the cellular level of the body can be refreshed and be continued and so on, cleansed and through breath. And the consciousness, the ego state, the true being can leave the body and go do other kinds of things on subtle levels. And when people are developed in that way, you spend half your life in the physical world dreaming, and it will feel the dream that we call the physical world, I shouldn't say dreaming, but in the physical world doing that thing, and you spend the other half of your life very awake and aware doing other things that affect the physical world. And that's one of the trainings we also do here. And so that the most of us have become aware in some time or the other that we are not this flesh, that when we've had the experience of someone close to us dying, and we've gone and we've come to see the body, and we've looked at it and we've realized there's no one there. They're gone. They're somewhere else. And the realizations about things like this that people have to experience, and the experiences one goes through when, as one gets older and one has parents or other people close to them who die, and the experience one has for the next 40 days or so after that death, which are so unique to each individual person, but which any clergyman who works with grief and with death and things like that is very familiar with a lot of these things. And these kind of phenomena, of course, multiply like crazy during wartime, for example, so-called psychic phenomena and things like this. People begin to have experience of another kind of reality and start to understand that we are not our bodies, and that when our bodies die, it's not as though we don't exist anymore. This flame doesn't exist anymore. The conservation of matter and energy means that all the energy in that flame is still here. It's in the room. It's turned into heat and other kinds of things. But that's not what happens when we die. When we die, it isn't like what happens to the flame of the candle. That is not what happens. And that's not what happens when we sleep, and that's not what happens when we travel in bodies other than our physical body. And we can travel in mental bodies and a couple of different kinds of astral bodies, and we have a buddhic, what has been called a buddhic body, and there all these things are discovered by people who have lived in situations where the interior life of what it means to be human has been fully explored. Now, we don't do that very well, not just in the West, but in the East either, but in any normal society, because from the minute a baby is born, we're shaking things at him and trying to get him to look at things and use his senses, and we're bringing him out of himself, and we're trying to bring a kid as fully as we can into matter, which is good. We should do that, but there are also other things that children need to learn, and they do need to learn silence. And they need to learn to be alone, and not to have to be habitually and constantly in motion. They need to learn to sit and be alone. Very important. Many people can't be alone. If they're by themselves, they freak out. And in places where the kinds of knowledge that come through very close contact with nature and through the grace of being able to explore the interior and to have especially wise guidance from other living beings who have, in those places, great knowledge is developed, for example, in Tibet, about these kinds of things. And that's where you have to go to find out about them, places like that and people like that who have. And I was very fortunate to have a living teacher who passed out of her body at the age of 97, who knew firsthand about all this kind of stuff and had undergone many empowerments and initiations through her lifetime and had served in very special ways. Did I give you a copy of my book of her life? Yeah. And that is the way that we begin to learn about these other dimensions of reality. And then when we start doing it, we start finding out what the territory is like. And we found out very quickly is that it's real dangerous unless you have some kind of guidance. If you take a little child, psychics, for example, channels, are like little children who at the age of 3 go walking out in the streets of New York. They don't know what they're exposed to, what they're next to. They don't even know what's coming through them. They know what they're being told is coming through them. But the truth is, the absolute, honest-to-God truth is, people who indulge their mediumship, and some of the people have it and some don't. Mediumship is a weakness. You must not indulge it. And people who indulge it weaken themselves, and they weaken the soul's development and the harmony within their own soul and their own evolutionary progress for the sake of certain kinds of contacts, that most of which are illusory. Masters can't come through mediums, and they don't come. If a master would come through a medium would blow up. To stand in the presence of a true master such as exists out of the body, would be such such an agony of the body, would be like putting jet plane fuel into Model T Ford. You wouldn't be able to hold the energy. It would hurt. It would be very painful. You couldn't stand in that. On the astral level, beings, the reason that a lot of people, just for protection, will say when they see a ghost or see something, they say, "Can you stand in the light of the Christ?" is because just by even speaking it, that energy is invoked, and those beings are very sensitive to it, and they can't stand around it. They can't be around it. And Mother Jenny, I said before, I mentioned one time when someone who was obsessed came into the room and immediately fell on the floor and babbled a while, and then all of a sudden was fine. And the entity that was obsessing her had left, not because Mother Jenny had exercised it, but just because she came too close to the aura of Mother Jenny, and she couldn't hack it. The entity couldn't stay in this body, and the body kept going, moving into it. There's a whole lot of skill that is necessary in dealing with obsession and possession. But there is a whole zoo of psychic life, a whole sea that we're in the midst of, most of which is invisible to us. But our souls, back to the subject of our own souls, are concatenations and conglomerations and grand structures and interweavings and interwebbings of billions and billions of lives. And our souls contain within them the thing we can take with us after we die. What can we take with us? Not our shoes, not our names, not our memories even, most of them. What we can take with us after we die is something that isn't verbal, it's not visual, it's not five-sense reality, it's a kind of nectar that we produce, and a kind of bitterness that we produce, and that we can take with us. And that will determine, that will come in, that nectar and that bitterness will come into us in other lives that we manifest in, and we will have to sweeten the bitterness with the nectar. And we are constantly producing nectar and bitterness, and it's not, we talk about karma and things like this, but these things, these accumulations that we have that are permanent accumulations can be achievements, or they can be serious mistakes. The soul can be thought of as a kind of an orchestra that's gradually getting larger and larger, and that works as long as everything is in harmony. But as disharmonies, but no orchestra is perfect, no soul is perfect. Some souls are like high school bands, and some souls are like the Boston Philharmonic. But no matter which group you look at, there's still cracks in it. There's still boo-boos, there's bad notes and things like this, but they're on very different levels. But to the musician who performs in the Boston Philharmonic, those things are even more grating to his ear, what happens in the Boston Philharmonic in a rehearsal, than the high school trumpeter when he hears the clarinets all out of tune. Because as you become more complex and more refined, those things become, there's greater power, there's greater vulnerability. That's the whole subject of imperil and the purifications and the defilements that we talked about, that the fact that people who are becoming more and more, as they become more developed, they also hit a ceiling like this. And that ceiling is something that we have to deal with through the purifications, because if we don't, we can't get through. If we are heating water, we can raise 1 gram of water 1 degree centigrade with 1 calorie of heat. We can raise it from 0 degrees to 1 degree to 2 to 4 to all with just one calorie of heat. But when we get up to 100 degrees centigrade, which is boiling, we cannot raise it the next degree unless we add 540 calories. We have a phase change. In order to change phase, it takes this tremendous push, 540 times what it takes to go up 1 more degree of heat. And in order to push through that phase change, there are certain things that have to happen. There's a tremendous lot of energy that has to come through. We are like that in this age and in this era, because we're a bridging age. We're bridging into what we call the new humanity, the sixth root race. And we are ourselves, and the sixth root race is mixed up and in the test tubes of living, walking human beings right now. It's happening in us right now. It's not something that somebody's going to give birth to. We're the experiments we're walking around right now. And this new humanity is a humanity that's extremely more sensitive. It's a humanity that's going to be a humanity of where lucid dreaming, where work in the astral, where psychic understanding, and I'm talking of higher psychic, not mediumship and all that sort of thing, channeling, where this kind of work is understood, and where the interior life of humanity is understood, and where life itself is much longer on the physical level, and there's many things can be said about this sixth root race that's coming through. But in so doing, we're at 100 degrees centigrade, trying to break through from water into steam, and it takes a tremendous amount of effort. And in order to achieve that, one has to know, one has to take the accumulations of wisdom that have come all through this root race and that tell us about how we make the next step. And that's Jesus, and that's Buddha, and that's every one of those guys. And we need them all. We need them all in order to truly understand where we're going and what we're doing. And when we say in order to become a Templar, one has to take the obligation of going through these purifications. That's why, because you just can't make the next degree unless you make it possible for you to do so, and you can't do it without certain kinds of purifications from these things. Now, let me just check something here. So the human soul is a great conglomeration of smaller psychic lives, but all these psychic lives agree to be called I, even though they're really we. We really wouldn't want them to. We would, if we really understood ourselves best, we would prefer to think of ourselves as we, because that, number one, recognizes the multiformity in the community that we each are as lives and cells, and our soul is, and the necessity of the cooperation of all the parts. psychological healing and the balancing of the physical body and all the forms of healing that were developed in the East and even in the West, although through another route, aim at trying to bring the whole organism back into balance. And that's what we is. An orchestra is we all in balance. When an orchestra becomes a group of competing cadres of different people who want to take over this, and the violins want to rule, and the trumpets want to kick butt, and everything else, you know, you don't get any music. And what you get is cacophony. Well, human beings can do that to themselves, to their souls. Human beings can bring in so much disharmony inside of them that they endanger their soul so that it can't really hold together as an integrity, as a one, as a unit. And what we in this human kingdom call evil, that is, the evil we have lots of definitions of what we call evil, which is people that do harm to other people purposely and all this kind of stuff. People who step on other people who commit genocide, people who do this to the ecology, to the environment, to the animals, to psychologically cruel people, all the kind of people that lie habitually, all this kind of stuff. As you get involved in this kind of activity, you start to build in cracks and disharmonies and bring in darknesses. And if that process is done in a thoroughgoing manner, and there are people who have specialized in it, I guarantee you, there two things can happen. Number one, the people can become temporarily very powerful by following this left-hand path. By lying, by having no compunction against snuffing people, anything you have to do to get what you want, you can become very powerful in this plane for a certain amount of time. Woo. That's why people talk about selling your soul to the devil, but you have to pay later on, right? You have 20 years, and then after that, it's down to hell, right? You know. Well, that's because that's what happens. When you do that, every time you sin against yourself, every time you sin against anyone, you sin against yourself most of all. Because every time you do these kinds of things, you are destroying your own integrity and your own, the harmony of your own soul, and you are extinguishing your own light, and you are destroying your own life. And it is possible, and the time does come, when people can experience, and the human soul can experience, what's called spiritual death. And that means, and that comes through a process of disintegration, eventually falling into a form of madness or something like that. And after death, these souls that were once unities decompose. What they have to do to achieve health, so to speak, is they have to decompose and fall apart so that each of the parts is within itself harmonious. And then those parts can start becoming parts of other monadic adventures, of other monadic journeys, and start on the upward path and developing into a human being again. But they have to lose their human status when they do that. They have to go down back below. This is an extreme example. Exorcism of the sort that the Master Jesus did and so on. Exorcism is freeing an individual from the from being temporarily obsessed or possessed by another consciousness or other entity, but it's not another person. It's a fragment of another person. It's part of another person trying to hold a self. It can be a whole other person. It can be also non-human things trying to hold themselves together as consciousness by sucking, by living on the etheric energies of a living incarnate being. Because once they lose that, and they finally are denied that, and they don't have anything to leech onto, they fall asleep and they fall apart, and to them that's the most terrible thing, the worst thing for a person who's very in lower consciousness people. The most awful thing, the most terrifying thing, is death. Death frightens people who have smaller and contracted egos, and the idea of losing consciousness, losing control, and so on. That part of a person is the part that is a very contracted consciousness, and that's what the consciousness of these people, and that these people, these entities, fear more than anything: death, falling apart. When what they really need to do is just to relax and let it happen, so they can get whole again. This is part of the process of exorcism and dealing with those kinds of forces. But the human soul normally doesn't go into that. The human soul is in all kinds of states of our conditions where it's not total and perfectly and purely harmonious. It's partially harmonious and partially unharmonious, and going back and forth between different kinds of states. And they're all conditions and sorts of the state of the human soul. And all human souls do not stand on the same step of spiritual evolution. They're in all kinds of different steps. The Sufis like to say that in the shape of a human being, there's everything from dogs to angels. And that's in fact true, but it's not something that's obvious or evident, because any standards that we apply to judge other people simply fall short. That we just can't see enough. We can't see enough to properly judge or evaluate any other person's spiritual progress. There's no way we can see enough. That's why in the New Testament, St. Paul warns that when people come along and ask for hospitality, give it to them, because you may be entertaining angels unawares, because the angels walk the earth, and you know, you never know who you're running into. So the human soul, the state of the soul, is not evident in an exterior way. Even we like to think that the people are saintly who speak in a soft voice and who are gentle with animals and who say nice things to people and wouldn't hurt a flea. Well, that's the image we have of a saint. What do we do with someone like Madame Blavatsky, who swore like a trooper, who took delight in playing psychic tricks on the most famous scientists of her time, who smoked like a steam locomotive and who ate like a pig and did all kinds of things. And she was a saint. But she was a saint because she was doing work of a sort that put her under such extreme pressures that the way she came out, her personality came out, was not what we would call a saint. But she was in fact a saint. And whereas other people who may look like saints and sound like saints, and especially to themselves, may be very far from it. So it really, there's no way to tell from the outside what anyone's situation is. We just go through this and do our thing the best we can and hope that the other guy isn't going to, you know, shoot us in the back of the head when we're not looking. But we really do. We are really, in truth and in reality, we can't tell what level. But there are all these different grades and levels of soul or psychic development that people are on. And just because you're here today or this week doesn't mean you're not back here again tomorrow. There's a lot of flexibility. Some 2 years ago, this guy might be here, and this guy might be here, and 3 years from now, they might find themselves in this position. Jesus took instruction from John the Baptist that all righteousness might be fulfilled. But then John the Baptist said, "But I am not worthy to unlatch your sandals," which is, means to be your disciple, which was one of the things disciples did to masters, was to take off their sandals and wash their feet and so on. And very often, and we're going to find this very much in the coming century, that the little ones, the children, the ones that we have to teach and raise, by the time they're full grown, or by the time they're 30, 35, may actually be our spiritual teachers and our spiritual guides. Because this is what kind of time we're in. The little child shall lead them. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. It happens this way. And so very often we end up raising our masters. It's very bizarre. Everything that's going on today is very different. And so the first thing to say about the human soul of anything else is that it's a great mystery. It's very complex. It's the gateway and the doorway between what we might call the human kingdom and what we might call the superhuman kingdom, the divine. It's a constantly changing situation. If Peter could go from 1 minute to being a great enlightened being to being a Satan, that's how quickly we can goof. That's how quickly we can go back and forth. It's like standing on this chair, then going and standing on this chair. When you're on this foundation, then you're on the right one. When you're on this one, you're on the wrong one. And we can go make that fast. We can go back and forth. It requires a great deal of discrimination in order to do that. We can be 1 minute in a very high and beautiful state, and the next minute we can be in the depths of something, and things can pull us down. Well, Peter was a very developed soul at the time that he worked with Master Jesus, but he was at like 100 degrees centigrade. He was working through that 540 calories it takes to make the next step. And when you get into that position, you're in a pressure cooker. And every flaw and every fault you have is going to come out crosswise in every way you possibly can. And this is what this world is like right now. But we're all in. Why are... we're not in a simple world where we can make rules that good die young, or the rich are bad and the poor are good, or something like that. You know, we're in a very complex situation here, and we have to really keep our eyes open. My teacher was just some old lady down the street. I didn't know who she was. I had to find her. She wasn't advertising, "Hey, come to me, I'm looking for students," or anything like that. I found her only by God's grace, and it took me a while of being with her. I didn't know why I was so drawn to her. It took me a long time before I started to see who and what she was. And that's how this all happens, and how life teaches you too, and the soul. Everything is a mystery. Everything comes to us in mysteries, and we're all in masquerade. in our human souls. We're all going through this kind of way. The one final thing I want to say about what I call the chalice, or that which the accumulations which we make from lifetime to lifetime, so to speak, that are not verbal accumulations. These things, which have many names for them, one of which is grace in the Christian tradition, but those achievements that we make, the spiritual achievements that we make, which is the greater expansion of love, because the consciousness is here. The consciousness is in the heart. It's not in the head. The head simply analyzes. The head simply puts things through. But the consciousness, the true consciousness, is in the heart. And the true beingness is in the heart. And the true expansion of beingness comes through the heart. And it comes through what we call compassion. And it comes through suffering. And it comes through joy. And one of the greatest ways people in the West think that the way that they progress spiritually is through suffering and all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, you do, because you deepen the cup, you deepen the chalice with your suffering, you deepen what you can feel and what you are. But it also comes through joy, and you cannot expand unless you are capable of feeling and holding joy, gratitude, and many other kinds of very high vibration and sacred emotions and feelings. The field of our feelings and our emotions is the field through which we grow and develop. And I'm not talking about sentimental feelings and things like that. I'm talking about our sensibilities, not our thought sensitivities, or not our thought descriptions.